banks in Europe and Japan are paying negative interest in a bid to jumpstart their economies.
If I look at what's happened in Sweden, if I look at what's happened in Japan following the negative interest rates, across the board, I would say that central bankers have been trying to tell a story that the market just hasn't bought into.
And that's the conundrum, is that you have to buy something, or you should buy something.
Bank of England's aggressive stimulus plan helping stocks extend their gains.
Job market's fine. Job growth has slowed from where we were a year ago, 2 years ago. So underlying job growth, abstracting from the ups and downs in the data, is about 150 to 200K, which is good.
Jobs are looking good. Today's number was a great number on the face of it. Yet the whole business sector is looking poorly. CapEx has been falling for well over a year, and so have profits. So there's a conundrum here. There's a paradox.
I think these numbers for the last number of months are just weird.
We're going to a state where growth is going to be slow for a long time, and as a result, consumers are not eager to spend. Firms are not eager to invest, and that slows down further the recovery. So demand is weak because the future is not exciting.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, just when you think things were looking dismal, well, the economics do a flip-flop. On this Friday, the unemployment numbers came in. The unemployment rate stayed steady at 4.9%, but jobs created came in at 255,000 jobs created. Gold dropped on the anticipation, well, gosh, these better economic numbers mean the Fed is more likely to raise interest rates soon. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Louise Yamada will be joining us. And as she said, you know, one of the most important things for any technician is price. And it's the technician's creed. When price no longer looks like the price for a reason which one bought or sold, one has to shift opinions to follow price. Otherwise, it's the biggest mistake. You'll want to hear what Louise has to say about the stock markets. I think it's going to be a rather surprise for all of you. She'll be joining me. Mark Chandler will be here. We'll be talking about the dollar, where it's going, what central banks are doing. The Bank of England cut interest rates a quarter of a point this week and announced quantitative easing. This time they're borrowing corporate bonds. They're also going to be making negative interest rate loans to banks, encouraging them to lend credit. All of that is coming up, as well as Ryan Poplava here to comment on what moved the markets this week in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, last week the markets were very surprised when the GDP for the second quarter came in just a hair over 1% instead of the much touted 2.6% that everyone had expected. Economists had it wrong. The Federal Reserve had it wrong. And the question is, why are so many people getting it wrong? It could be we're moving into a switch here, and a lot of people haven't grappled with the new rules. The world is out in territory that we haven't seen before, and a lot of flags are up indicating that we might be turning down into a recession, but the pickup on that is very, very slow in the markets, and the consumers don't seem to be concerned about that either. That'll be the first part of the big picture today. And financial repression has now gone global. As I said, we're out in historic territory. We're looking at events that the world either hasn't seen or we haven't seen in thousands of years, especially negative interest rates in Europe and Japan, possibly coming to where we are in the United States. We are definitely in uncharted territory. So if we look at changes that they are underway, what is driving this? Because the markets seem to be operating under distortions, looking more towards what government is doing rather than operating on the fundamentals. As we said, new and uncharted territory. And finally, after a long period of doldrums and flopping around, everybody's talking up gold again. It doesn't have a PE ratio, it doesn't have an interest rate or a dividend yield, but everybody's bullish on it anyway. So why is that when it doesn't have a return? All of that under discussion today for the big picture as part of the Financial Sense News Hour. Well, Ryan, I can state the obvious. It is August, and in August, for most news work, you know, Congress isn't in session. That means everybody can breathe a big sigh of relief because things are safe for a month anyway. We say, well, it's going to be a slow news month, but I kid you not, How many August months have we seen over the years where all of a sudden the market takes a dive and, of course, the panic ensues? It did that last year when Jim and I were away on vacation. What do you think? Is this August going to be different, or is it just going to be the same old, same old?
Yeah, statistically, it is not a great month for the markets. Neither is September and October, but it's funny. We've got an inside joke here, John. Every time Jim goes, he does his little sometimes monthly, weekly vacation in August, and the markets go down. So we kind of have correlated to his little vacation. So we told him, you know, take it easy this year. You know, interesting that you should say that, because it's so funny. At the beginning of the week, Goldman Sachs and Jeffrey Gundlach, head of Dubline Capital, both said to really bunker down in their own way. You know, Gundlach in an interview said sell everything, citing expensive valuations. And Goldman basically said the same thing, but he said they're downgrading stocks to underweight. That just means, you know, if your portfolio says I should be 50% in stocks, then they're saying, hey, go a little bit below that. Valuations are stretched here, as we've had, you know, a few quarters of declining earnings if we base on earnings estimates for 2016. But, you know, surprise or no surprise versus the street, the trend has been down. But it's also about now that analysts start comparing stock prices to 2017 earnings. And I don't know how, but they just do, with us looking at 2016 earnings with a grain of salt. But they just do. They start looking at 2017. And those expectations, as of course, they're higher. Kind of reminds me of the last time we dealt with valuations in the late 90s, when we were in what they called the new normal and valuations didn't matter. Valuations, of course, still matter. That's what Gundlach is saying. That's what maybe Goldman Sachs is saying. And that's why I think the market has been consolidating since mid-July. But it appears with more central bank stimulus this week and just a strong U.S. jobs report that the market may be exiting this two-week consolidation in favor of higher highs. I mean, that's what happened on Friday. We closed higher.
That's true. You know, I'd heard there were some rate cuts, and I think Japan finally formalized an official stimulus package. But you did say the market really didn't move on those things until the jobs report, right?
Yeah, that's true. The story I'm hearing from a couple of trading desks is that the Japanese will be introducing about 28 trillion yen. That's roughly about 276 billion US dollars as a fiscal package, but it doesn't contain enough direct government spending. If you look at spending from their fiscal programs, a lot of it is like, here, we're going to credit you some loans and this and that, but not enough. Hey, here's picks and axes. We're going to do some infrastructure build out here. It's really not enough, they're saying. It's really a small amount. Most of the headlines I read were smaller than it looks. Same old thing. Will it work? So a lot of doubt. So it definitely did not help the stock markets, both overseas and here. Another problem, John, that some are citing, that this just adds to the debt to GDP and doesn't really fruitfully add to GDP. This is just going to add more debt than growth. So that definitely looks like the case given the programs they're looking to create. So definitely, market was underwhelmed. And yes, the Bank of England did drop rates a quarter of a point, which was largely expected. So if the market expects it, it's not going to move off the news up or down. And if you remember from the last meeting, which we said they had intended, they didn't cut rates in July, but they dangled the August cut little carrot out there. So the two things that were not expected that they did follow through with this month was they stated they will increase the government bond purchase program to 60 billion pounds. And they introduced a new facility here, about a 10 billion pound monthly purchase of corporate bonds. So that's new, doing the whole government bonds in addition to corporate bonds now. The S&P futures did respond to that, moved up a small amount, up like 6 points in the futures market before our market opened up Thursday morning. But really, no, you're right. The jobs report on Friday was the big catalyst. The S&P 500 closed up 18.6 points. And that was the most influential news item I could really tell you about this week.
Well, okay, but the non-farm payrolls report for July showed 255,000 additional jobs, and how come that wasn't too strong a point to knock the rate futures off their rocker? I mean, it's, but usually the bears would poo-poo such a strong number, stating that the Fed will have to raise rates sooner now. I mean, as in a good number is bad? Is that what we're hearing here?
Well, finally, John, you know, a good number is producing good results in the markets, and that's what I appreciate. I'm glad that's happening. It was actually viewed as a solid print that confirms the growth we saw in June. It was really, when we looked at May alone, it looked like a real outlier. Job growth that was, I forget, was it like 24,000 jobs compared to the average that we were seeing long before that, which was much higher. I think the average now is around like 190,000. In May, that little drop was a concern, you know, when we were talking about it on the show. And then June came out with a huge number. And then we had to look at that in doubt as well. We had these huge gyrations in jobs reports, getting us another solid print here for July's job creations. That kind of affirms that, okay, we're on solid ground with the job creation. You know, things have bounced back considerably, but before that, the trend was down. So we looked at that, and we looked at the details to see, okay, what else is here? Was it too much, or is there something else here that would be interesting to see? And the hourly earnings were up around 0.3% compared to a 0.1% increase in June. So that was another really great component that we saw in the jobs report here on Friday. And I think the market really responded positively to that. The unemployment rate stayed around 4.9%. The participation did tick up a little bit, but not greatly. Earlier in the week, we saw some great inflation numbers. They weren't too high, and great spending numbers. We saw some real spending increase. So spending up, hourly earnings up, so that consumers can afford it, or they can feel comfortable about spending more. The only concerns on the economic front that we saw this week were China's official Purchasing Managers Index data figures for July, which were down very, very slightly to 49.9 from 50. 50 is the line in the sand at which we calculate expansion or contraction. Any number below 50 would be contraction. So it's right on the border. But interestingly, there's another number that comes out that kind of gives us an idea of what's going on in China as a whole. And that's another different private PMI reading number, which really is focused on smaller businesses as opposed to the large businesses that the Chinese official PMI really focuses on. And that number actually, for the small businesses, went up to 50.6 from 48.6 in June. So overall, a great week in economic reports. And as I've mentioned, John, all summer long, we've had fairly positively good economic numbers. The May jobs report was the only outlier, it seems.
Okay, Arun Poplava, back to the Fed talk this week. Let's change the spotlight here. Some of the FOMC talking jaw heads said that the market's too complacent over the rates, given financial markets, that they've stabilized from the Brexit instability and from Brexit talks. And now we've had two solid job prints. So what do you think?
Well, I looked at the Fed futures data on Friday. And if we were looking at it on Thursday, the probability of December hike was right around 29%. At the end of the day on Friday, 39%. So a quarter point hike in December is right now roughly around 40%. Most of the time that we see rates actually go up, you would want to see that probability really skyrocket before a policy decision date, and we've typically have seen that. But just to give you an idea of how influential the jobs report number was, a pretty decent increase in that probability based on the market's interpretation. So, you know, with that, bank stocks, we want to look at, how does this influence everything? How do investors react to this? Today, bank stocks got a real big boost. Treasury prices dropped, yields went up, and gold went down about 2%. So I guess if we're talking about FOMC talkers here, Fed President Lockhart gave some indications of what he felt was appropriate. He's not a voter this year, but he did say that he wouldn't rule out a rate increase this year. He said stock valuations are looking buoyant. And we did hear quite a few people all this week, obviously, from, as I said, Goldman Sachs, Jeffrey Gundlach, and several others. But he did say that when you look at interest rates, if you look at valuations in stocks and you pair that to an environment of very low interest rates, relatively speaking, he said, valuations are reasonable. So that's just that financial repression. You know, with rates this low, investors have to look for yield, and they're seeking that in riskier areas. So after everything is said and done, the yield chase continues in equities, obviously, this week. And here we are with new highs in the S&P 500. And the S&P 500, just as you know, is up 6.75% this year. And it really wouldn't surprise me, John, if we continue higher, just given any kind of performance anxiety. We really haven't had many dips this summer to buy. And so it's just been straight up this whole July rally post the Brexit issue. And I'm assuming that any kind of dip is going to get purchased unless we find some catalyst that kind of reverses the sentiment here.
Yeah. So we'll have to see that. It's the great big will it or won't it, very much like will the Fed raise or lower interest rates. But August just seemed to have this thing about it. Anyway, anything else investors should be watching next week of import?
Well, I think the news this week leaves a lot to digest. I think the income and spending report was a real important release this week. It showed that personal savings, the rate dropped to 5.3% for March, and spending growth going up. That tells me that people feel comfortable about spending. We've seen some consumer confidence reports that are going up, and the age of deleveraging may be coming to an end. All of that started back in 2007, and all that consumer deleveraging, government deleveraging, very important to see here if a new trend is developing, and that could very well add that final push to the final phase of a bull market, where you finally get into that comfortable investor emotional position, and at some point, euphoria and greed. And that's typically how bear markets begin, is out of greed. So haven't seen that yet. Could be around the corner for the next year or so. Who knows? But, you know, that year-over-year increase of 2.6% in hourly earnings, that's helping. The savings rate dropping and spending going up, you know, that's helping. And that could mean some great things for retail industry. So I'm definitely going to be watching that. I think these figures will be important to watch in the months to come as we sort of evaluate company earnings and economics together.
Okay, we're going to take a company pool on the August thing. We'll all lay bets and see who comes the closest to a blowout date or something like that.
Yeah, there'll have to be some sort of event or catalyst, because we've got central banks flooding the markets with capital, liquidity. Everybody's accommodative, and so far the Fed seems to be holding off.
Yep, seems to be. So, well, we'll see. It should be interesting. Anyway, Ryan Poplava, good to see you again. Have a good weekend. Since we are now in August, don't forget to enjoy the rest of your summer.
Will do. You too.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Joining us on the show today is Tyler Kling. He's the co-founder of MacroOps, a global macro research and education firm. And Tyler, when we last spoke to you, I believe it was last month, you talked about how the stock market was at a very important inflection point that could lead to a breakout to new all-time highs or a breakdown. And a large part of that depended on what would take place in two key areas that you were monitoring. If we fast forward today, we see that there was a brief bit of panic after the UK voted to leave the EU. That was late last June. But then really, just as quickly as the markets fell, we rebounded to all-time highs in an almost straight vertical fashion right up. And on the day you and I are speaking, stocks are now sitting in record high territory. So before we get into why you think this rally may have some legs behind it, what you see with investor sentiment, China QE, and some of the sectors that you like, would you mind filling our audience in on those two key areas you were watching when we spoke to you last month and where that puts us today?
Yeah, sure. So the reason why we focus so much on junk debt right now is we really like to watch from a macro liquidity level to determine where asset prices are going to go. So if the junk debt market is in distress, you know, that means credit spreads widen. It's more expensive to borrow capital, and that's a downward pressure on equities. So that's why we usually keep track of junk debt as a thermometer or temperature for overall macro liquidity. And what we saw there last time we were on is that if this junk debt was going to roll over, then we would see downside again and a downside breakout in equities. But like you said, after Brexit, everything rallied really hard, and that was true of junk debt as well. So it had a tiny down move and then instantly rebounded. It's now since broken out of its congestion area. So that's a pretty positive thing in terms of a liquidity standpoint for U.S. equities. And then emerging markets, that's another good tell, because the way we look at the world right now is we feel like U.S. is the cleanest dirty shirt, so to speak, in the room. And we don't see any scenario where emerging markets rally and U.S. equities don't. So we see U.S. equities can rally without emerging markets, but they're not going to go down as emerging markets go up. And that's, again, just due to the fact that right now in the world, the U.S. market still looks like the most attractive place in terms of the data and, you know, the growth. And also, they don't have that overhang of the U.S. dollar carry trade in the U.S. So emerging markets, you know, a lot of people are concerned that if the dollar starts to strengthen again, then that's going to hurt a lot of emerging market companies that have dollar-denominated debt. That's not the case in U.S. equities. So that's, emerging markets is really key to take the temperature of U.S. stocks. And so when we came down after Brexit as well and held a trend line and then ripped out of that congestion zone again and have since held at higher levels. So that inflection point in terms of the way we look at it has been resolved now to the upside. And we feel pretty strongly that this rally in U.S. equities now can persist in the midterm, given the fact that emerging markets and junk debt remain in a really strong position.
Well, just when you thought stock prices were heading down, stock prices broke out. Recently, they've pulled back here. What's going on with the market? To get an in-depth view, joining me on the program is Louise Yamada from LY Advisors. Louise, let's talk about a quote you had in your newsletter, and I'm going to read it here. It says, "In price, there is knowledge, is the technician's creed. When price no longer looks like the price for the reason which one bought or sold, one has to shift opinion to follow price. The biggest mistake is to hold a former view in the face of changing evidence." So, Louise, let's begin our discussion on the changing evidence as you documented in your recent newsletter.
Clearly, we've been quite bearish during 2015, seeing the evidence, the technical evidence, suggesting that the market should continue to go down. Well, we saw in early 2016 the big drop in January, February, and then the market picked up quite significantly and came almost all the way back to the upper level of this wide trading range between 2100 and 1800 on the S&P. And then we started seeing potential evidence of a reverse head and shoulders bottom coming into place, with the lows from 2015 representing the left shoulder and the low of early 2016 representing a head upside down. And then the consolidation that was taking place as 2016 moved on as possibly the right shoulder. So we started suggesting in early July that perhaps we were looking at the possibility of a breakout through the upper trading range boundary. And we have since seen that, of course. And now the implication is that the markets could move higher. You can take a measured move from that reverse head and shoulders from the head to the neckline and project price up from the neckline, which would take the S&P to 2400 and the Dow toward 19,000 and possibly higher over time with interim levels. 2200 would be the first potential stop for the S&P 22 something. But yes, and if one had continued to be bearish, because that was our view in 2015, and even though the technical evidence was showing us stronger readings, you started to see new highs exceed new lows, and you started to see our volume momentum with higher rising volume than declining volume. And you can't ignore that because you had a fixed view prior to that point based on prior evidence.
Now, one thing that we've seen sometimes when markets are in a trading range has happened between, let's say, late 2014 to recently. When they break out, you talk about sometimes there's a potential for a bull trap where basically it looks like the markets are breaking out, but it's sort of a head fake and we head back to, let's say, lower lows. What's the possibility of that happening, and what would you be looking for if that indeed was a possibility?
Well, it's always a possibility, and certainly during 2015, we saw a lot of these horizontal consolidations break out only to see the individual stock prices fall right back into the trading range and continue sideways. So we've had the breakout here, and I think what we would watch for on this pullback is for support levels to hold, the first one being, of course, the breakout level itself, around 2100. And otherwise, if you see it come back down into the wide trading range and approach 22,000 again, then all bets are off. Perhaps you're going to have to continue in a sideways pattern. But so far, the technical indicators look nothing more than a pause, new highs versus new lows, exceeded levels over the past year plus, and are simply pulling back so far in a perfectly normal fashion. And the same thing with the volume momentum. If we started to see that move into what we call oversold, where the declining volume exceeds the rising volume, we would consider that a risk concern. But at the moment, we're watching here. When something breaks out, it usually consolidates above that breakout level or within the breakout level and should continue to move higher. So this is a watching period for sure. But so far, the indicators seem to suggest nothing more than a consolidation.
Now, something you discussed in your newsletter, you talk about we've seen the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the S&P 500, 600, 400 break out to new highs. The NASDAQ is only, what, a little over 50 points away. But we have not seen the Dow Transports in the Russell 2000. Let's talk about Dow theory, which is, you know, the transports have been failing to confirm the industrials. Now, some would argue that the transports today are much different than the transports in the past. So let's talk about the transports validating the Dow. What's your theory there?
Well, the Dow theory suggests that the companies that make the goods and the companies that transport the goods should move in tandem to suggest that the economy is copacetic. And at the moment, we have a divergence. The Dow is at new highs, and the transports are struggling to stabilize near their lows. But Dow theory doesn't have to have an immediate confirmation. It can take weeks, it can take months for a confirmation or a non-confirmation to prove itself. So I think we have to give it a little bit more time. Clearly, the railroads have been quite involved in the transportation of oil, and that could continue to be a problem if the price of oil goes lower. We think it may stabilize around here, but nevertheless, this is definitely a negative divergence at the moment. So we'd call it a potential negative divergence until proven otherwise over the months ahead.
Now, you also made reference that what we've seen may have some similarities between the 1994 and 1995 stealth bear market. Let's talk about that and what would be some of the similarities.
Oh, you really do read these reports, don't you, Jim? You're wonderful.
Well, your newsletter is so well written, and I pay a lot of attention to it, so I do my homework.
You're very kind. Yes, the interesting thing about this period that we have just experienced, of course, is that the small and mid-cap stocks fell to considerable bear market levels. If you think about some of the smaller energy companies down 80% or so, they've certainly suffered bear markets. Yet the S&P and the Dow were only corrective trends. They didn't go down the bear market threshold of 20%. And the last time that happened was 1994-95, when the small and mid-caps got really clocked down 75% in many cases. But the Dow and the S&P were only down 9%. So we've dubbed that a stealth bear market because so many stocks did get hit, but the major indices did not. And thereafter, in 1995, the indices moved up. We got our monthly momentum buy signals in place again after having been on a sell. And the markets, obviously, we know from 1995 to 2000 moved up with a couple of interim setbacks. But nevertheless, it's conceivable that we're seeing something similar today, where the large indices, the S&P and the Dow, could be initiating a new upleg, which we would expect the small and mid-cap stocks to follow.
I want to move on to September because you think that could be a key month, but I also want to make reference to your study on election years. And you did a study at your firm of the four-year presidential cycle. The second best performing year for the stock market is actually the election year, with the average performance roughly around 7.5%. Louise, I don't know about you, but in my lifetime, this is the most unusual election that I've ever seen. So
that's for sure. I'm not sure we can predict anything from the past on this one.
This is definitely one for the history books.
It certainly is.
So we do know that there's a lot of liquidity that has come into the market. On the day you and I are speaking, the Bank of England cut interest rates for the first time in 7 years. So there does seem to be a lot of props underneath the market, whether it's liquidity, interest rate cuts. The majority of central banks are either cutting or actually going to negative interest rates. So let's talk about this election. What are the possibilities? What are we up about 5 or 6% right now for the year? So we could be hitting that historical mark.
Yeah, we could indeed. It might mean sideways action for a period of time. It also could mean that September and October might not be so bad, and it's what the result comes out at the election day that could affect the market, because I think it's hard to predict what the outcome is going to be.
Let's talk about two particular commodities in their relationship to the dollar, which you believe is in a trading range. Let's talk about gold and oil. I mean, after hitting all-time record lows for oil in February, the price nearly doubled, and now it's pulling back into bear market territory. Let's begin with oil. What's your take there?
Well, what we've been looking at in oil for most of this year is the possibility, again, of a pattern of a reverse head and shoulders, where the early 2016 low is the head. The pullback in late 2015 could be the left shoulder. And then we've been suggesting for a couple of months that if oil were to pull back from 50 toward 40, 42, that it could create a right shoulder. You've certainly seen the 2014 downtrend penetrated in the second quarter of this year, and the pullback so far has not slipped back below that downtrend. So I think some stabilization here, even if it were to pull back another point or two, would argue the possibility that oil could stabilize and move up. Now, if we start to see oil come under $36, then that pattern, I suggest, will be considered aborted. But I think right here, it's done exactly what we anticipated, and we'll see whether prices can stabilize in the $40 level area.
Well, let's move on to gold, because on the day you and I are speaking, it's roughly around $1,370. And you talk about if it goes through 1400, gold could stretch to the next major resistance back in 2013, which was around 1540. If we get near that, that is one heck of a move. And if you look at some of the gold stocks, they're up over 100% this year.
Some of them are doing very well. There are others that are really struggling, but some of them are doing very well. We're already up 30% in gold from the bottom, and the bottom almost reached our $1,000 target. So the first piece of evidence that gold might be on the move came in place when we lifted above the late 2015 rally peak around 1191, I guess. So 1200 had been our resistance level, and it moved through that very nicely. And for the past few weeks, it was captured between regaining the 2005 uptrend above 1300 and the 2011 downtrend, which had come in around 1360. And right now, it looks like a perfectly normal consolidation, and we would anticipate that gold could continue to lift. But, you know, it needs some time to consolidate and digest the gains, 30%. And if it can continue here and move up through 1400, yes, indeed, it slowly lifted above each of the lower peaks that took place from 2013. We had lower highs and lower highs and lower lows, and it's already gotten through about three of those declining peaks, which is a plus. And it has its own uptrend now, which comes into place around 1300 as support. So right now, 1300 is a good support and would retain the uptrend if gold were to come down there. I don't see it coming down there, but it's a possibility.
So explain for our listeners from a technical perspective, when you see, let's say, the downtrend that began in 2011 all the way to, let's say, February of this year, when you see this long downtrend that has lasted for several years and you break above that, how significant is that in technical terms?
That's a significant move. The old saying is you can't go up until you stop going down. And one of the pieces of evidence of stopping going down is breaking through a prior existing downtrend, because those downtrends define lower highs followed by lower lows. And if you start to break up through that, you begin to reverse the trend, and it suggests that accumulation is coming into place rather than distribution. In other words, people are buying the dips rather than selling the rallies.
And when we look going back to the stock market, you know, each year we come up with these little mnemonics. You know, last year it was FANG, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. This year it's STUB, which is staples, telecoms, utilities, and bonds. What do you see that looks very strong in this market move to you?
Well, I think one of the interesting things which we've been toying with is whether or not during this negative interest rate environment, the staples and the utilities and the telecoms are perhaps becoming offensive rather than just defensive in their progression. All three of them are on monthly momentum buy signals and have been for some time, suggesting that a leadership is there. They may have months here and a month there where they underperform, but overall the prices are continuing to move to new highs, and that's what the momentum is based on. So even though there may be slight pullbacks in those areas, they continue to do well. We had hoped the industrials could break out and sustain a breakout. We'll have to see whether that comes to the fore. Technology, I think, has definitely come back to the leadership fore. So that's a plus, and that's, you know, a good weight. And I think healthcare may be also trying to repair and turn up. A lot of the pharmaceuticals have been moving up. So we may get an addition to those three leaders as the weeks and months go by.
I want to just get your opinion. I mean, you have years of experience in the market, but when I look at a treasury yield screen, I mean, when you have a 10-year note at under 1.5% and you go overseas, you have negative rates, and then you take a look at utility yields or consumer staple yields that are at 3%, almost twice what you can get in, let's say, a 10-year bond, doesn't that add some support to the market? And the reason I'm saying that, Louise, CalPERS just came out recently, and they announced their returns for 2015, which were less than 0.7%. Now, here's the nation's largest pension fund that needs to be earning 7% and 8% to meet their pension obligations. Doesn't that in some way force large pension plans to search for yield where they can find it best?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think that they've had a lot of problems with some of the municipal bonds, particularly Puerto Rico. So yes, these sectors may, as a result of these very low interest rates, be drawing interest from many of the areas that are desperate for yield. And that makes them perhaps leadership sectors for this period of time, at least up until we see the Fed raise rates again, and then maybe we reevaluate. But I don't think moving from, you know, up 0.2% is going to make a big difference in the 10-year yield. And of course, the 30-year, we think, is, I would call it almost irrelevant because they've stopped issuing it. So as there's a demand coming in for the 30-year, of course the yield is going to drop because there's no additional supply, which is not true for the 10-year. But the 10-year broke down, there's no question about it, and it has made a little bit of a abortion of our 6-year head and shoulders pattern for the 10-year, suggesting that something out there is telling us rates may stay low for a longer period of time even. Now, we know that interest rates reversals from falling yields to rising yields can take 2 to 14 years. In 1929, we saw the low of that bear market in 1932, and interest rates didn't start up until 1946, which was 14 years later. So we're now maybe 7 years into what we thought was a basing process, and it may have to continue for another few years.
So given the fact that we're heading into September, they always say the markets shift in September, the big boys come back from the Hamptons, we've got an election going into November, if you were looking at the market right now, what would you be doing?
Well, I think that there are a lot of stocks that have broken out nicely. You've got these leadership areas. I'm not sure that I would jump into utilities and telecoms at this point, but if you have them, I certainly wouldn't sell them. And what we suggest is the stocks that you do have that you might have bought or had for a long time or bought on breakouts, you just keep raising your mental stop loss, whether you're comfortable taking a 7% or 10%. You just keep raising your mental stop loss as the price continues to go higher. So if the price retreats to that point in your percentage risk tolerance, you take some off the table and protect your gains.
Well, Louise, as we close here, spend a few moments and tell our listeners about your newsletter. I know you do a lot of work for institutions, but you also have a newsletter for individual investors. Tell our listeners about that.
Oh, that's very kind of you to mention. We do have, it's a monthly piece. And it covers all the markets, global, domestic, commodities, currencies. I'm sure I'm leaving something out. But we generally try and give a sense of all of the markets for our investing public. And you just Google by name and go to the website and send us an email, info@LYAdvisors, and we will be happy to send samples and details.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Does the thought of working for 60 or 70 years fill you with dread? Or can you see the potential for a more stimulating future as a result of having so much extra time? Many of us have been raised on the traditional notion of a three-stage approach to our working lives: education, followed by work, and then retirement. But this well-established pathway is already beginning to collapse. Life expectancy is rising, final salary pensions are vanishing, and increasing numbers of people are juggling multiple careers. And that's the subject of a new book called The 100-Year Lifespan, Living and Working in the Age of Longevity, and one of its co-authors, Andrew Scott, who's a professor at the London School of Business, joins me now. Andrew, let's talk about this, because I can remember when Social Security was put into place in 1933, the life expectancy of a male was age 65. Today, it's probably closer to 85. And as you write in your book, longevity has been increasing by 2 years every single decade. So let's begin with this 100-year lifespan. What is making that possible?
It's a raft of different things. And as you rightly say, if you look at the data over the last 200 years, in every decade, what we call best practice life expectancy, that's the country with the highest average, has increased by 2 or 3 years every decade. So it's plausible to suggest the children being born today have a very high chance of living to 100 or even more. If you look at the work of Professor Jim Vorpal, he says that a child born in America in 2007 has a 50% chance of living to be 104. So, you know, this is this extraordinary increase that's been happening. What's behind it? It's a raft of things. It's certainly partly medicine. It's better income. So the nutritional intake of expectant mothers is better. And a huge role is better public health and better public knowledge. And of course, this is not a gift that everyone faces. I'm 51, so my life expectancy is probably 90, as opposed to my children. And it's not something that's automatic. It's not you take a pill and you get it. There's all sorts of behavioral features that you need to follow, exercise, nutrition, etc., if you're going to get there.
Well, the dollar has been in a bit of a downtrend lately, but this week the Bank of England cut interest rates from 50 basis points down to a quarter. Are more rate cuts coming around the globe? And what about the Fed? Are they going to be raising interest rates later this year? What does all this mean for the economy and the dollar? Joining us from Brown Brothers Harriman is Mark Chandler. Mark, let's begin with the dollar. It's been in a downtrend recently, although the day you and I are talking, it's up. As I look around the globe, interest rates are negative in Europe, they're negative in Japan, And even though interest rates here are, let's say, 1.5%, which almost looks like junk bond yields when you look overseas, what are the prospects for the dollar going forward?
Yeah, no, good question, Jim, because I sort of see it a little bit differently. I look at from an economic point of view, not a trading point of view, but just from an economic point of view, I look at what the Federal Reserve tracks, what they call the real broad trade-weighted dollar. What the real means, it's adjusted for inflation. Broad trade-weighted means it includes like a wide spectrum of U.S. trading partners. So what's happened to that is that's actually gone up 3 months in a row through July. And so this is, again, a trade-weighted adjusted for inflation. And so I think that the dollar has, leaving aside the Japanese yen, which sort of marches to beat a different drummer, I should say, that the dollar is fairly firm. I wouldn't call 111 in the euro, 110 and a half in the euro as a weak U.S. dollar now. But I do think that the weakness of U.S. Q2 GDP and the idea that the Fed is not going to raise interest rates anytime soon, that means for over the summer, it has meant June and July meetings. And I think this has encouraged some speculators to think that the dollar has topped out. And so in the futures market, speculators are short most of the major currencies now. Actually, they're long most of the major currencies, short the dollar against them.
Mark, as we look at this and we look at central bank policy around the globe with the Bank of England cutting rates this week, the only central bank really around the globe that still keeps talking about raising interest rates is the Federal Reserve. And yet we've seen some of the economic numbers. It looks like the economy peaked in the second quarter of 2015. Economic growth rates have been tapering down. We have a 1% growth rate here. What are your thoughts about the Fed? What are they thinking when we have rates this low?
My sense is that many people probably agree as well that the GDP is not a good metric for the overall U.S. economy, and especially when you want to try to set policy. So even though that Q2 GDP was weak, but the story really, as you say, the economy looks like it peaked in the middle of last year. So what's going on? Here's what I think is going on. The Federal Reserve and economists make a distinction between what they call real, or say final domestic demand. That is the GDP number, and you exclude two things from it, inventories and trade. Because both of those things arguably are not really influenced by monetary policy per se, or not so tightly or directly. When you look at that, so what's happened is in the last 9 months is the U.S. has experienced a very sharp inventory cycle. Demand has been met out of inventories rather than through current production. That is bad news immediately, but it is good news forward-looking, and that's where markets are so important. The markets are forward-looking, anticipating, and what we should be anticipating, and so what do people like me do? We look at, rather than taking the time to try to create our own models as if we had that skill to begin with, the New York Fed and the Atlanta Fed have created models for GDP using real-time data. So today, for example, the Atlanta Fed came out with their new forecast for GDP. And we're looking at, because they run down inventories for 9 months, they're going to rebuild the inventories. And that'll show up as inventories are considered business investment. That's the category. That's the bucket in GDP measures. So I'm suggesting to investors, pay attention to the final domestic demand component of GDP, and realize that the drawdown in inventories is going to have to be replenished. And that looks like what's happening is going to happen here in Q3. What this means for the Fed is the Fed may not have to be in a hurry to raise interest rates. After the employment data, we had the July employment data earlier today when you and I are speaking, and the Fed funds futures market, which is a fairly efficient way to think about what the market is pricing in, went from a 18% chance to a 26% chance of a hike in September. 26% chance essentially means 1 in 4 economists think it's going to happen. But as long as this final demand story holds, a December rate hike, we've got 3 meetings left in the year. September, and the market, like I say, is saying 1 in 4 economists say it's going to happen. November, but November is too close to the election. So that means that December seems to be the most likely time frame for a Fed rate hike. And again, the Fed is watching labor market. We had a very weak May number, but now we've had 2 strong numbers, June and July, so we could feel fairly maybe more confident than we could a couple months ago that the labor market remains intact. On August 1st, we had auto sales numbers, and auto sales bounced back fairly strongly as well, and increased about almost 1 million units at an annualized pace. over the previous month. And so that means consumption is holding up here in Q3. And so I think that we should be looking for a stronger dollar, Fed to have this a tightening bias, while September is going to be a very important month for what other central banks do. The Bank of Japan and the ECB have indicated they will be reviewing policy then. And when the Bank of England cut rates, they also intimated that a majority of the Monetary Policy Committee expects to ease policy further this year.
So as you look at all this, and let's take a look at gold, we have had a downtrend in the dollar, which began earlier in the year. Gold has had a very strong comeback after hitting a low in February. If the dollar was to strengthen, as you foresee, let's say economic growth picks up in Q3, that would obviously show some weakness in gold. We saw that today with the better job numbers. Gold pulled back. What's your take on gold here?
Yes, I think one of the things that make gold attractive, not so much for Americans, but for other global investors, is when you have negative rates or near zero interest rates, the opportunity cost of owning gold, a non-interest-bearing asset, becomes cheaper. And when the problem is, and we've just had this problem in Europe, I mean, the Italian banks have been under pressure. They've had the ECB just had a stress test. We know that negative interest rates are squeezing big profits. And when people are concerned about problems in the banking sector, they also tend to like gold. So I tend to be agnostic on gold. I don't tend to think of it as a currency. I tend to think of it as another commodity, but I do recognize its unique psychology for many investors. And today we're testing the 20-day moving average at about 1338. My sense would be that this is an intermediate top in gold. It's basically testing those highs from early July. So we have a potential double top in place. And so we got to go through the neckline, of course, but neckline is down to 1310. So my sense would be something like this. If we take out 1310, that would put gold about a $60 move, which is about a 4 or 5% move, which would bring us back below 1300, maybe a 6% or something. So yeah, so that's the kind of like magnitude we're looking at, I think, just on this double pattern. But with negative interest rates overseas, and the squeeze on bank profits, I think that a lot of speculators are going to be more inclined to buy gold on pullbacks than sell it on rallies.
So as we look at the commodity complex, we had a nice, we hit all-time record lows or close to record lows in February. We had oil double almost in a period of 3 months. Now it's back to $40, and some say it could go even lower. There's a gasoline glut, which is hurting some of the big oil companies. So we've had this pullback on the commodity complex. And of course, we know commodities are priced in dollars globally. So if the dollar strengthens, does this also spill over into the commodity complex and especially oil?
Yes, that's what a lot of people focused on is the dollar's, the exchange rate's impact on commodity prices. And the difficulty I have with that is that one is that a lot of the commodities you're talking about are sort of more the industrial commodities as opposed to the food commodities. And of course, the food commodities like the grains, even the livestock to some extent, are going to be more cyclical and weather related. It seems to me that the industrial commodities, the CRB index, has trended lower. Even when the dollar, even when the dollar was weak, commodities are still trending lower. But my sense is something like this, is that if an investor, one of your listeners, have a strong view on oil or copper, iron ore, I would recommend trading those based on those commodities fundamentals rather than the foreign exchange impact, because their correlation between a currency and a commodity might not be that stable. In general, we've had slower world growth in Q2. U.S. economy disappointed. The Eurozone economy grew half of what it did in Q1. It grew in Q2. Grew 0.6% quarter over quarter in Q1, 0.3% in Q2. Japan's going to report their GDP numbers soon, and it looks like it's pretty close to stagnant there. And so we do have weaker demand, and that's partly why the IMF, World Bank, OECD keep revising down world growth. And so that's not good for commodities. Stronger dollar, like you say, on the margin, not good for commodities. China is still wrestling with its oversupply. And that's going to mean, even though iron ore and some coal prices, the coking coal prices have increased, we've got to anticipate that China has basically turned a lot of these commodities into surplus. I should say a lot of the semi-finished goods that come from these commodities, like steel rather than the iron ore, turn them into commodities and basically has debased the price to the overcapacity. I talk to Dennis Gartman once in a while, and this is he's a newsletter writer, and he says during the early days of the crisis, he told me that in this kind of situation, he said, you want to buy things that hurt when you drop on your feet. You know, remember, commodities were still taking off in early 08. Oil prices peak in the middle of 08, and so it made a lot of sense. And now I think maybe the reverse. We still have the whiffs of deflation, low inflation, and so tends to be not a supportive time for commodities.
So when you take a look at what we've seen in this, I guess, summer, describing as PIMCO did, the new normal, we're seeing economic growth rates that keep being revised down. I don't care if you're looking at global growth rates or even growth rates here in the U.S. In this kind of world, where you have other countries that are not doing as well as the U.S., and some are talking about broader trends like deglobalization, deleveraging, depopulation, meaning an aging population, a slowing workforce. Perhaps, you know, Mark, what we're really talking about is the new normal is growth rates between 1 and 2% rather than the more explosive growth rates that we saw in the last decade that were fed by leverage. Do you buy that view?
Well, I do think that we're in a period of slower growth, but partly we're in a slower growth because we have a slower population growth. I think about a country like Japan. Like I say, it's probably going to be stagnant here in the second quarter. Here's what's happening. Their economy is shrinking, but the population is shrinking faster. And so you have actual per capita GDP increases in Japan despite the stagnant overall economy. So I do think that demographics are playing a big role in how we measure these things. We also have this problem with productivity. As world economies, the high-income economies, even countries like China, where the manufacturing sector, remember what happened, right? Our grandparents, our great-grandparents were on the farms. This was agricultural. And then they moved to the factories. And then we moved from factories to offices. And the same measures of productivity that work on the farm, how many bushels of corn per acre, how many widgets per hour, it changes when we come into the service sector. I teach at a New York University. If one semester I have 25 students and the next semester I got 60 students, am I really that much more productive? I probably would be a little bit less productive because I can't get the same attention to each student. Same thing with a string quartet. Do you really want that string quartet in the name of productivity to get rid of somebody? A doctor, a social worker, would a social worker sees 25 families versus seeing 50 families? Are they really more productive? And so I think that we do have a problem with productivity as well as some of these big headwinds that we don't fully understand about the forces that could be slowing the economy and that can be here for what Yellen says is a sustained period of time.
So, you know, as we look at Fed policy, the latest consensus seems to be that if they do anything, and I suspect they would be reluctant to raise rates in September ahead of an election, because, Mark, I think the Fed got surprised when they raised rates in December and saw what happened in the first 6 weeks of this year. So, you know, the economic news has not been very clear, or they can't be confident in those numbers. Let's talk about the Fed going forward. And what are the possibilities that, you know, most recessions have been triggered by, let's say, the Fed raising interest rates because the economy was overheating and also there was a rise in inflation. Now, if you look at this presidential election, both parties, whether you're looking at Trump or you're looking at Hillary Clinton, both are talking about accelerated spending. And we hear talk about helicopter drops. Do you think that's what's coming next? In other words, a large stimulus package that is basically financed by the Fed?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think it'd be financed by the Federal Reserve. As you know, the Federal Reserve has stopped buying Treasury bonds. I think it's something like this, that the Federal Reserve, I think, I might take exception to the idea that the Federal Reserve, they were shocked or surprised by the way the markets reacted in early January. I think that in early January still, I'd say that from the Federal Reserve's point of view, from an official's point of view, probably attributing more of the market volatility to the steps that China was taking with its currency and gave a greater degree of uncertainty. I think the Federal Reserve does not regard its December rate hike as a mistake. And if people do think it's a mistake, I think that you have to be prepared for the Fed to repeat their mistake. It does seem that we have changes to the economy that make it hard to navigate. But I think with this low growth, low inflation environment, some fiscal stimulus, when you look at, like you say, the political cycle, both candidates are talking about some fiscal stimulus, but it's really a question of how that fiscal stimulus is paid for. What people mean by helicopter money, I think, is what you said, is that the central bank prints off the money, in effect, creates the money, and credits the central government's account with it. I don't think that that's what we're talking about. I don't think that's what the Federal Reserve is thinking as the next step is going to be. Before we get to that, there's a lot of other steps that would have to be taken. And this kind of growth in the economy, again, even though the GDP number looks poor for a soft patch to the economy for the past 9 months, I'm one of the people who were surprised by second quarter GDP, roughly half of what I thought it was going to be. But when we look at the numbers, the underlying economy is not that weak. And I think that for most investors, focus on the labor market, because that's what the Federal Reserve does. Remember, consumption is 70% of the economy. 70% of our economy driven by consumption. As long as the labor market stays healthy, that is people gaining jobs, getting paid a little bit more an hour, and this time the work week increased. So not only are more people working, getting paid a little bit more, but they're also working a longer week. It doesn't sound like a lot, but because we have so many people working, the 6-minute increase in the work week is almost the equivalent. If you turn it into full-time equivalents, hundreds of thousands of jobs, that's going to matter for the output. So I think that the economy is not as weak as the GDP numbers suggest, and I think that's the way the Federal Reserve sees it. And the best way to focus on and thinking of how what it means for the economy is focus on the 70% of the economy, and then we have to do our best interpolating that other 30%.
So given that view, Mark, if you were to put, let's say, money to work right now, what would you be doing? Would you be focused more on the U.S. and U.S. dollar-based investments if you think the dollar to improve and the U.S. economy to improve, or would you be putting your money overseas?
You know, good question. I'm still scared of these lofty levels in the stock market, even though I realize that there's two models, right? We have a fair value model, and then we have some kind of understanding of what the liquidity is going to do to, you know, sort of like a rising tide lifts boats. So I'm nervous still about committing more money to the stock market on a general, like on a broad level like that. I do think that because what Europe is doing, and Europe, and that's the Eurozone, the Bank of England, and Bank of Japan, all three of them are buying corporate bonds. That is good for businesses because it's going to lower their interest rate, lower their cost of capital. However, I am bullish the dollar, and so I still like these ETFs that allow investors, small investors like myself, to buy a foreign stock market and hedge the currency exposure. It doesn't always work. As you know, the dollar yen went from, like, say, 125 down to low 100, and being hedged was not a good idea. I was hedged. The Japanese stock market sold off. I'm still holding that position, but the yen is much stronger now. And the government, or I should say the BOJ, just announced they were going to be buying more Japanese stocks. They're buying as the stock market weakens. And so I do like these kind of broad ideas of buying the foreign stock markets. Those central banks are not raising interest rates, and you've got them buying these corporate bonds. On the other hand, what I see a lot of our clients doing, and again, our clients are institutional money. They're not individuals so much, but the people who we give our money to manage our pension funds, our 401ks, what they are doing has been buying East Asian stocks, and particularly Taiwan and South Korea, Thailand. I think that's partly a play on valuation, and it's a play that avoiding the commodities, and it's looking at sort of in that emerging market space that had been so beaten up.
So given that, I know you don't like the lofty valuations in the stock market. In fact, we're at levels, depending on which kind of measure you look in terms of valuation, at levels that last seen since 1929. But on the other hand, Mark, if you look at utility stocks, consumer staples, some of the oil stocks, you can get dividend yields of 3-4%. I mean, that may not sound like much, but when you're looking at treasuries at 1.5%, or one-third of the globe's sovereign debt at negative rates, that almost sounds like junk bonds.
Exactly. And I think you're right. I think that's one of the things that make attracting people to equity markets is they're getting practically no yield from fixed income. And so it's almost like treating equities like fixed income. And it works. And I say it works until it doesn't. The reason why many companies give high dividends, and it's typically not because they're generous. Sometimes it's a way to give back money to investors, meaning that the management doesn't see a better place to invest the money. There's also, of course, on dividends, of course, there's a tax obligation as well. But in general, I think people are well into that play, whether it's preferred stock ETFs, high dividend indexes. But I do think that's like a big factor here that's helping keep stock markets at such strong prices and such stretched valuations.
All right. Well, listen, Mark, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work and put a plug for your book, by the way, it was an excellent book. I enjoyed reading it. Talk about your book and how they can follow you, please.
Sure. Well, the book was called Making Sense of the Dollar, came out in 2009 by Bloomberg. But the good news I have for you, Jim, is I am working to get another book out by the end of this year, shortly after the elections. It's going to be called Political Economy of Tomorrow. It's going to be partly an analysis of the crisis, and then what does it mean going forward? So that's something to keep an eye out for. I'm on Twitter. My handle on Twitter comes from trying to market that book called Mark Making Sense on Twitter. And I also have a blog. The Brown Brothers lets me experiment with this blog called Mark to Market, Mark with a C. And even though I write, I put most of the stuff is for institutional investors. I have had to develop over time to be able to explain and work with these complicated ideas, but explain it to people who might not have all this nomenclature, this special lingo that Wall Street uses.
Much to be considered coming up next in the big picture. The canary in the coal mine. There is a recession on its way. You know, last week the markets were surprised when second quarter GDP came in just squeaking over 1% instead of the 2.6 that everybody expected. The economists had it wrong. The Fed had it wrong. The markers, the LEIs, the PMIs, all kinds of flags that were turning into a recession, but very slow pickup on it by the markets. And the consumer seems oblivious to it since the consumer is puttering right along. Housing prices up, auto prices up. Good feelings seem to be out there. Although, if you notice, the restaurant attendance is beginning to slide, and that's usually the first indicator of a recession. So we'll talk about the various canaries in the coal mine right now, indicating where we'll probably be by next year. Historically, by the way, we're in totally new territory, stuff we haven't seen on the planet in several thousand years. We're looking at the lowest interest rates in recorded history on a regular basis, negative rates in Europe and Japan. What does this all mean? Especially with changes in the law underway, and you really need to understand that the markets are really being distorted by what governments are doing rather than by market fundamentals driving them. And finally, after a four-year hiatus, it's back. Gold seems to be popular, even though it really doesn't have a PE ratio, no interest rate, or a dividend yield. But there it is. It's popular, and everyone's urging for it. So all of that's topic of conversation coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.